I just wanted to introduce you. I've just discovered that you are Dr. Joseph Gerson. That's, of course, not very important. You're very active in the academic field and apparently also in the peace movement, and already from the 60s, I have seen.
Yes.
So you've also written some books about the bomb and also about the network of US military bases with the funny title The Sun Never Sets.
Is that good research?
Yes, no, just a little. Then you are involved in the protest against the NATO summit that's in about 1 month and a half now, I think, in Chicago.
That's right. That's right. The focus is on building a counter. We're focused on building a counter summit conference to build our movement for the longer term. There are other activities going on as well.
So this is only a part in a long-term strategy. And in what peace movement are you that is involved in this long-term campaign? Because there are several in your country, aren't there?
We have a number of organizations. I'm with the American Friends Service Committee. We've got
And what's that one? American
American Friends Service Committee. It's a Quaker-based organization that has a Nobel Peace Prize. We're working with Peace Action, which is the largest of the peace organizations in the United States. And then there's organizations like Grassroots Global Justice, who organized the U.S. Social Forum. We've got the involvement of groups like Jobs with Justice. So it's an interesting network that brings together a fairly wide range of organizations.
And they all have quite a long history.
Most of them do, we have a combination of long-term organizations and then some newer ones.
And is there also any connection with what's happening with the whole Occupy thing now?
Some of the organizations have ties with Occupy, and there'll be some Occupy in Chicago. We don't know quite how many, so we'll see how that develops. And Occupy is a little bit like Quicksilver,
Yes.
in terms of where it goes, what its priorities are.
Not very predictable.
No, but also creative.
Yes, of course. So the NATO summit is, I think, for the 20th and the 21st.
Right. Our conference, our counter summit, is the 18th and 19th. There's a march, actually two marches planned for the 20th, and 21st. I'm not so sure what's on tap at this point.
So originally, this NATO summit was almost at the same moment as a big G8 summit, also in Chicago.
Right. We were all quite surprised when initially the G8 was really to be just a couple of days before the NATO summit. I think what happened was that at that point, the people who initiated the Occupy movement called for 50,000 people to come to Chicago. Others were, I think they were expecting just to have a mass of people to come to be protesting focused on the G8. I think the White House finally figured this out and decided that this would not look good as it approached the presidential and congressional elections in the fall. And so they moved it to the more secluded Camp David. And I think that will reduce the number of people who are coming to Chicago. That's their plan.
So the G8 is not in Chicago anymore.
No. It's in an extremely rural area of Maryland where protesters will have to find it almost impossible to get anywhere near it.
So was the protest originally, I had the impression, was very much joint? There was
Initially, yes. We had to revise the call of our conference once our counter summit once we learned that the G8 was going to be a part of it, and we're still going ahead with the strong economic justice dimensions to our counter summit.
Economic justice. That's so it's it was all. I saw this word CANG8 demonstration.
Right, Engage. That's a formation that was created closely related to an organization called UNAC, and they've been focused on holding a peaceful demonstration on had initially been scheduled for Saturday the 19th. They now moved it to Sunday the 20th.
Okay. And Kengate, that was the original name to protest also against G8 then, or not?
It was formed. Yes, it was initially this group called UNAC, which was calling for anti-NATO summit activities. And then when the G8 was to be in Chicago, they created a new organization called Kengate, Campaign Against NATO and G8.
And it kept the name even when G8 was in fact not part of the deal anymore.
That's right.
Okay. So how many people are you expecting in Chicago?
It's hard to know. It's very, very hard to know. I think our counter summit, we're looking on the order of just simply about 300 people. We're looking at a significant conference that builds us over time. I think the people organizing the various marches are hoping to have up to 5,000 people.
5,000, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And will people from?
I think it's important to understand that that NATO has really never been high on the priority list. Most people in the United States don't really know very much about NATO at all. And so with the summit coming, it provides an opportunity for us to kind of help people understand what NATO's global role is. So it's part of a longer-term building process.
So what do they think it is, then?
What do they think NATO is? Most people think NATO is a somewhat benign organization that was created during the Cold War. They have very little idea that NATO is at war in Afghanistan or Libya. The idea that the United States uses NATO to occupy major portions of Europe, maintain nuclear weapons, is all rather beyond most people's understanding.
So that's a bit like here, where many people seem to think that it's a kind of worldwide police force protecting democracy and freedom and women's rights and things like that.
I think people here don't have much idea of the worldwide. I think the thought is that it's probably still principally in Western Europe. The little has changed since the Cold War.
Ah, yes, but they do understand that the NATO is an organization with many members.
Some people may know that. Most people don't wrap their head around it too far.
So they don't think it's a kind of extra army of your country?
No.
They don't think anything at all?
most people don't think much about that. The truth. And the peace movement has been focused on the U.S. dimensions of the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. dimensions of the invasion of Iraq, and the two big oceans have insulated many people from in this country, in the Atlantic and the Pacific, from understanding much about the wider world.
It's a big country, but it's still kind of island mentality then.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so.
Yeah. So 5,000.
Those are the numbers that people are talking in terms of. But we really won't know until we get there.
Okay. And what about Chicago? It will be hosting this NATO summit, but it will also be hosting the protests. I read some very weird things about how the city of Chicago was anticipating to that.
To begin with, Chicago has quite a history of brutal repression of demonstrations. I'm going back as far as 1968, the Democratic Convention was notorious for the police assaults on demonstrators, and really beginning last fall, the police have been saying that they were training 13,000 police for mass arrests, so they said to prevent chaos. So they're preparing to impose their version of order. This seems to go really with any major gathering these days of world leaders. I was just in Korea at the counter-summit activities for the nuclear security summit. They had mobilized 40,000 police, but in the event, they weren't particularly violent. So we'll see how it plays out. Of course, within NATO, we had the Strasbourg summit, the 60th anniversary a few years ago, and you really saw the police state moving to defend these leaders.
Yes. Well, but there is, of course, some legal frame normally where you can express your thoughts and have a rally. So there is some kind of legal...
At this point, what's happened is that they have granted a permit for the march. So that is in place. I think the question is there is
whether... For both marches, then?
For the Cane Gate march, that permit has been granted. I think the veterans are still waiting for their permit. A number of vets are planning to march and to throw away their medals, a sense of understanding that what they did was wrong and wanting to be free of that. And that'll be, I think, quite dramatic. So they have given permits, although there was some struggle to get them, but they do have a series of very repressive laws about the need to approve what banners there, where you can actually go. Length of sentences for any kind of trial for people who are deemed to have violated those laws. So there is increased repression.
Very strange. For the land of the free. Do you think there will be any act of civil disobedience?
There's been some discussion of it. It's hard to know if they'll move ahead on that quite yet. I frankly hope that War Sisters International would be more deeply engaged in it. We'll have to see how that develops.
And War Resisters International is a?
War Sisters International is an organization committed to nonviolence and to justice. One of its affiliated organizations, the War Sisters League, is involved in organizing with us. I know they have had some discussions about that possibility. There's a lot of nonviolent training going on in Chicago at the moment, so we'll see what develops.
A lot of non-violence training, that's always handy, not only for this stop, but it can also be handy for other actions. What about the educational part you were talking about earlier? So people don't seem to know very well what NATO really is and what it does. Are there now courses or, I don't know, what other means? Are there educational efforts?
What we're doing in some cities is holding educational programs, both about NATO and economic globalization, as a way to build toward the summit itself. This week here in Boston, where I live, we had a major program with a man named Vijay Prasad, who's a professor at the university and very prolific, and a woman named Elaine Bernard, who is an authority basically on labor unions and their struggles. It's a way in which we can also help to build and unify with, in our country, been long separate movements, the peace movement and the movement of organized labor. So we're trying to see what we can do to kind of build the two together. But the major education organizing, it will be in Chicago itself.
Mm-mm. So, and do people realize what NATO is costing?
You know, it's interesting because there was a question in the forum we had the other night about the cost of NATO or some aspect of it, and the government doesn't provide a separate accounting line for NATO. It doesn't provide a separate accounting line for things like military bases. So, you know, it's very difficult to have that kind of accountability. I mean, the best estimate we have is that the U.S. spends about $111 billion simply for its foreign military bases. That's certainly more than any other country in the world spends on its military in total. So this number isn't well known to people, but it's a principal focus. I mean, as in Europe, you know, it's listeners know, we have a major economic crisis, major unemployment. The economy is stagnated. Perhaps unlike Europe, our infrastructure is rotting. We're not really prepared for the 21st century. At the same time, you know, we have this massive military spending. The U.S. total military budget is on the order of about $600 billion. And clearly, if we're going to revitalize our economy, it has to come by cutting military spending. So this is a major thrust of what our peace movement here is doing.
So back to the summit itself, what do you expect from this summit? I mean, not the protests, but the summit itself.
The summit itself, I mean, I think the main elements of it are going to be a focus on legitimating the long-term presence of the United States and NATO in Afghanistan well beyond 2014. That's going to be the primary focus, especially as that war is in crisis and the diplomacy is going nowhere in terms of trying to end it. Secondly, the United States is going to attempt to press the NATO allies to increase their military spending. We hear this from Secretary Gates before he retired. We hear it from Secretary Panetta. And you know, the idea that the Europeans would increase their spending for their military and for NATO at the time of Euro economic crisis, it makes obviously no sense. And thirdly, they'll be focusing to reaffirm the so-called new strategic concept that was adopted in the Lisbon summit, basically increasing the expectations of European militaries engaged in the actual war fighting itself in exchange for them having somewhat greater power within the alliance. And this was the this is the foundation for the invasion war in Libya, ostensibly a humanitarian intervention. But not surprisingly, after the war, Britain and France were given first access to the oil reserves and the resources of Libya.
Yes, so it's not very humanitarian. My yes, Joris, the other person here, also has a question for you.
Well, we sometimes see the NATO as a vehicle of the United States, so it's a way for the U.S. to expend some of the costs or move some of the costs to its partners. So we pay for the wars that are staged by the U.S. And also we are then buying, like the Eastern European countries, when they entered the NATO, they started buying American weapons. So you could maybe in a cynical way say that for the American population, it's not a bad thing, because rather than the Americans having to pay for the wars to keep America the greatest nation, it's being the costs are being shared with its partners. What is your response to that point of view?
Yes, I mean, what you said is really quite true. You know, NATO has, I think, from the beginning, involved exploitation of people, you know, from the very beginning in Western Europe. I mean, for those people who have looked at its origins, you know, what you know is that the U.S. moved to create NATO at a time when the Soviet Union really was not posing a great threat or a significant threat, I mean, to Western Europe. But that was the rationale for its creation. NATO was Soviet Union was a country that had been just absolutely devastated by the Germans in the Second World War. They lost 20 million people. Their industrial infrastructure was shattered. And, you know, the fear in the United States, you know, had to do with misperceptions of what was going on. I mean, basically the Yalta Agreement gave the Soviet Union predominance control in Eastern Europe. But this was, I think, from the Soviet side, understood to be essentially a buffer against yet another invasion from the West. So you have that. One of the things that I think is important to do is to read what the geostrategists in the United States actually write. A critical person is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter, the founder of the Trilateral Commission, and so on and so forth. What he says is that, look, for the United States, for any country to be the dominant nation in the world, it has to have predominant influence in Eurasia. And then he says that the United States is an island power, as E.S. was referring to. The United States has to have toeholds on the periphery of the Eurasian continent. So that would mean in Europe, in the West, and the South, it's been Middle East, and now with Afghanistan, in Central Asia. And then in the East, where the United States has had bases, still has more than 100 bases and installations in Japan, similarly in Korea, and around that periphery. So this is how the United States does that. And it's interesting, Brzezinski himself in his book, The Grand Chessboard, refers to the U.S. allies as our vassals. And so, you know, vassals can be asked to carry the heavy weight, whether it's financial burden sharing, whether it's providing the troops, and so on. So it's been a relationship that's been anything but equal, and certainly a violation of the kind of basic democratic values that most of us here were raised believing was essential to the identity and future of the United States.
Mm-hmm. President Obama has outlined his new strategy, and I think there were two messages. One was that supposedly the military budget would go down, and the second was that there's a shift of attention to Asia. What is your view and response to those strategic options?
Well, the reduction of the military budget, I think we need to understand, is minimal. The U.S. military budget has nearly doubled since President George Bush, the lesser, if you will, became president. We had 9/11 and the invasions. So what you have so far is some minimal trimming of the military budget. More is ostensibly coming, but the pushback from the right is such that we may not see any of that. At the same time, the U.S. strategists are just looking at some efficiencies in how they proceed. I think a recognition that war in Europe is unlikely at best. The Soviet Union or rather Russia at this point is recognized as not posing an imminent threat to Europe, and so the U.S. is looking to focus to concentrate its military buildup, the weapons development, the bases, and so on and so forth, in two locations in the world. On the one hand, to reinforce its power in the Persian Gulf because of the oil resources there. And then secondly, in East Asia, the analysis goes that East Asia, Asia itself, has about half the world's population. It's the most dynamic area in the global economy. It will soon be the most powerful economic force in the world. If the United States is going to maintain privilege and great influence there, it has to reinforce its military presence there. And so this is where the big game is moving.
Okay. So are you still...
We're talking about Europe. There's the anti-missile system, I think, that the NATO plans to install. And you mentioned that Russia is no longer really considered as a threat. So I was wondering if it's why do they think they need it? Is it against Iran? Is it against Russia, who also see it as a threat? Or is it just to keep the military and industrial complex in business? What is your point of view with that anti-missile system?
It's probably a little bit of all of them. It's interesting when you look at what the U.S. military and political leaders say about China, which at this point doesn't really pose a military threat to the United States. So, well, we have to hedge against the future. And I think certainly from the Russian perspective, they see the construction of the missile defenses and the related bases, and they really can't be sure what the U.S. intentions are. The U.S. has been saying that these are to protect Europe against the growth of Iranian missile forces and Iranian blackmail, and in part this could be true. But at the same time, as this technology is developed, and the United States refuses to really share the really deep information about it, to share control over it with the Russians, the Russians are afraid that it will eventually be part of a U.S. first strike force. The way their thinking goes is that the United States will have so-called first strike forces. The United States has a first strike nuclear doctrine that we would attack first. And then the fear and the idea is that the missile defenses would be there to essentially knock down any remaining retaliatory Russian missiles that might be headed back toward Europe or the United States. And should the United States be able to have this capability, then it's in a position to essentially play the game of nuclear blackmail against the against Russia. So this is the thinking there. You know, any major foreign policy dynamic initiative usually has more than one rationale or motive behind it, and so clearly the force, the dynamic of the U.S. military industrial complex is a major part of this. This means jobs and profits for some sectors in the U.S., especially, you know, the military industries.
Yes, that's also what I heard about this system, that it's not really a defense system, but more a support of an attack system.
Yeah, I mean, there was to have been a summit between NATO and Russia in Chicago that would have taken place at essentially at the same time as the NATO summit, and the Russians under Putin now canceled it. They say we just don't trust what you're doing. In fact, within the next week or two, the United States is about to announce that these missile defenses are operational, and the Russians take this as a significant slap in the face, an important step in the direction of this U.S. Coercion against Russia.
Yeah. Okay, our time is up, and I think...
Okay.
You may still have other things to do.
Okay, well, thank you very much for this opportunity. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to kind of build bridges between the United States and democratic people in Europe.
Okay, we might call again.
Okay.
And a lot
thank
of
you so much.
Courage with the work to do.
Thank you.
Bye.